Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every week on restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis. How are you today?
I'm doing well. I would like to speak today about a culinary and cocktail issue that I came across while doing my Christmas shopping.
In a restaurant?
Nope. Are you intrigued? Are you intrigued?
A little.
All right. Brookstone.com.
I love stuff at Brookstone.
I do too.
Really cool stuff.
Fly and remote
really
control.
Really cool stuff, yeah.
You can be massaged by a machine while you fly another machine around the room. And another machine's making your ice cream for you. Props out to Brookstone.com. Anyway, molecular gastronomy and molecular mixology have arrived.
They've gotten to Brookstone.
DIY kits for molecular gastronomy and a DIY kit for molecular mixology. The Cuisine R Evolution Kit and the Cocktail R Evolution Kit can have you do something really interesting that probably doesn't taste very good.
We're going to call those DC kits.
Well, you know, the thing about...
Don't
invite me over when you're making... You know, the thing about molecular mixology and molecular gastronomy is it's interesting because it plays with the structure of food, it plays with ideas about food, and then the hands of someone who's really sensitive and intelligent, like Ferran Adrià or José Andrés or Grant Achatz or...
It'll create something I don't really like all that well either.
No, I see, and with those guys, I think it's like really interesting and really tasty, and it comes from a frame of reference and that's kind of like modern art, you know? Which means I don't like it as well as 17th century Spanish painting because I'm an old-fashioned guy like you, but it's really good, you know? Like, I admire it.
I can see the quality therein, yes.
But in the hands of an amateur, that in the hands of some really good chefs who could make good food otherwise, they start like messing around with textures. Well, here, let's see what you can do at home and make some untasty stuff that looks interesting. You can transform the molecular structure of your favorite foods, creating chocolate spaghetti, lemon foam, and more.
Could we put all those together? Because that's the other thing I notice about people who like to do molecular gastronomy. They like to put flavors together that don't marry. Like chocolate spaghetti and lemon foam.
I think that spaghetti is made from the chocolate.
Yeah,
I'm sure. Well, but you know, the other thing is when you get those things on a menu in a great restaurant, you're like, oh, Grant Achatz has said he's going to do that. Let's see if he can do it. And then you taste it and you're like, oh, I didn't know onions and coffee and chocolate could work together, but they do and they're amazing. You can't do that. Don't be ridiculous. You're no Grant Achatz. You're no Bob Kennedy, sir. It comes with it's 50 recipe DVD, 5 tools, and 5 food additives. Doesn't that just sound delicious, 5 food additives?
Sounds like every box in the supermarket.
I love coming here. The additives are so great. And then there's a new cocktail R-Evolution kit. Deconstruct your favorite cocktails to create a mojito bubbles, martini bites, and more. Just give me a mojito.
We're going to call it less.
Can I drink
it? Okay, it's not more.
All right, I'm not a big fan of that, although I would buy it just to make fun of it.
I have to talk to you. You know that we just recently got in a new toy. You mentioned Grant Achatz.
Oh, yes, I do. It's not looking to the future. It's looking to the past.
Mentioned Grant
Achatz. Oh, my
Achatz,
God, yes.
And Grant Achatz had on his menu for one of his menus, and we talked about it on the show, a duck press. So since that show, I've been swearing I'm getting a duck press, and I've been looking on eBay, and I've been looking all over
like
the place.
$4,000.
And they're crazy expensive. Anyway, I found an old antique duck and or sausage press on the internet, and apparently, they're out there. There were a couple companies that were making them, and Francis and I have bought for the restaurant a duck press. Now, for those of you who don't know what a duck press is, basically, after you make duck,
you
butcher the duck, you take and cook it. You take the bones and you smash the bones into oblivion so that all the juices that might be left in the meat on the bones and the fat on the bones and inside the bones trickles out in this tiny little amount of some of the tastiest gook
planet. If you were to roast a duck, what would happen classically if you had like a silver duck press or something? Sometimes when people had a little more stomach for this kind of stuff, they would wheel the duck press out into the dining room. They would carve the duck table side and then put the duck carcass into the duck press and crank it down and then use what came off the bottom. And you hear like in the dining room. People had more balls back then. and they would use that, sort of essence of duck carcass to finish a sauce table side.
And I'll tell you, we've been playing with it. It's spectacular.
Yeah, it's really a lot of
fun. So the duck sauces in the restaurant are going to start to have all these things on them. We're doing a goose for an event in the near future, and we're going to do the same thing with the goose carcass. And we are having chef's eyes lit up.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny because we talked about it. He's like, oh, that sounds like fun. This thing finally came in the door. His eyes lit up. He's like, okay, let's butcher some ducks. Let's get this thing going. Come on. I got to try this.
Way more fun than any of the modern gadgets we have in the kitchen. So if you'd like to see us come and crush some ducks, you can email us at francis@restaurantguysradio.com. I look forward to crushing some ducks myself. Animal rights activists should call somebody else. So we have a great guest coming up after the break. Kevin Zarelli is going to be joining us. He has updated his book, the best-selling wine book in the world, Kevin Zarelli's Windows in the World Wine Course book. He'll be with us in just a moment. Stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys, and we have on the line with us Kevin Zarelli. In the spirit of full disclosure, Kevin is an old friend. He's not that old. The friendship is quite old. And Kevin is the author of the best-selling wine education book in the history of the world, and there's a brand new edition that is really cool stuff going on. Kevin Zarelli's Windows in the World Complete Wine Course. He is one of the most popular and famous wine educators in the world, and really one of the people single-handedly responsible for getting more people passionate about wine from the 1970s through today than anybody in America.
Kevin Zarelli, welcome to the show.
I'm just going to call every day. I can hear what you guys just said, to make me feel good. It will start my day off really good.
Well, you gotta accentuate the positive, you know, Kevin.
I think so. I agree with that. But that was very nice. Thank you very much for the introduction.
Well, I have to say, you've been on the show before, but people should know that, I mean, you are the one who made me say, wow, wine was always sort of an interesting side thing for me, and I took a consumer class of yours, and I was in the business, and I said, you know, something went off in my head, said, you know, I got to have something to do with this in my career. And so many people that we know in our careers who are contemporaries, from Michael Skernick to so many people who you had the same effect on, man.
And Kevin, I have to say, I've always thought that both you and Francis in this case are a little bit nuts. No, passionate is the word I'm looking for. Passionate.
And actually, you know, I will admit my age. Actually, I just had my 62nd birthday on Tuesday. But I started when I was 20. Actually, I started when I was 19. So I guess I'm on my 42nd or 43rd year. But it's very important that the listener understand that back in those days, wine was not anything of what it is today. People didn't drink wine. Or if they did drink wine, it was very, let's call it inexpensive stuff. So it had to be passion. It couldn't be anything else because there was no way that you could make a living out of it. If you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It was a liquor mentality, a beer mentality, but wine was not part of that whole equation of drinks.
But even in the 80s, when I got into this business, Kevin, I saw the wines I saw people drinking were white Zinfandels. You know, I saw people drinking something that was a little sweeter. You know, it was mostly women, frankly, that were drinking
wine
at that time in the early 80s, and it just wasn't cool to be drinking wine, and people finally figured it out.
It's still today in a lot of respects what you're saying, because you're saying white Zinfandel. Maybe in my day when I started off, it was like a Yagu Sangria. But, you know, even in today's world, and I'm speaking of maybe the younger crowd, which is actually the most important crowd right now for all of us in the business, the millennials, look at the Moscato. Moscato is one of the largest selling wines now, hot wine, so to speak, as maybe Sutter, Holm, or Behringer, White Zinfandel were, or back in its day, Matus Lancers and Yago Sangria. So again, it's a change in the marketplace. But of course, the most important thing is that the United States now is the number one consumer of wine in the world, after overtaking Italy and France over the last few years. And the most important thing to me is that it's 18 months of continued growth.
That's
actually
amazing.
18 years of continued growth.
You know, it's funny, but when you point out that Moscato now is really popular, it's really popular among rappers, and I think there's a qualitative difference though between the Yago Sangria and the White Zinfandel, which were, frankly, there were a lot of technically flawed wines, and there were a lot of really middling wines that were just sweet, and that's all they had. And where there's certainly some mediocre Moscato out there, there's some really great, technically well made, really good wine. Has the palate gotten even more discriminating on the very basic level? Because I think it has. What do you think?
Oh, over the last 40 years, absolutely. People are really into wine, and they're looking around for the best wine at the best price. And this is something I think I might have talked to you about on the last show, but I did travel around the world. I finished my trip 2 years ago. I went to 15 countries. I went to 200 wine regions. I went to 400 inner appellations, and I tasted 6,000 wines. And I did it all in a 365-day period just to see what was going on in the world of wine. And I came to the conclusion that this is the golden age for wine in the history of wine. And that's the good news. The bad news is that there's now, when you walk into a retail store, there's 6,000 SKUs, the different wines to choose from. How do you choose? And then the other side of the good news is there's so many great wines today, great wines, yeah, that are under $30.
You know what amazes me, and not to be the voice of negativity here, what amazes me is that there's still, and why I think wine education is so important, and wine education of consumers and getting people to understand a frame of reference, because that's what, I think that's what your basic course has always given. And, in teaching our courses, we still use your book. 20 years we've been using your book as the base because it's the best one. But there are still a lot of really crap wines out there. And I'm always amazed when I go into a liquor store that through whoever paid off whom or whoever made a mistake or... there are people who are spending $13 a bottle or $14 a bottle on wine that is, sometimes technically flawed. You can say, oh, that's volatile acidity. It smells like nail polish remover. Or it's just not very good. And sitting right next to it on the shelf will be a $9 or $10 bottle of wine, and a lot of them that are, exciting and great.
And sometimes it's a $50 bottle of wine that has a technical flaw like that you can see.
I have a little different take on it. Right now, I'm sitting at Sherry Lehman, the wine store in New York.
Sure.
Which on 59th and Park. I'm looking at all the traffic on Park Avenue. And I have a club here with these guys. It's called the Sherry Lehman Kevin Cirelli Wine Club. And every week we taste wines. And the club, though, is there's different clubs. And one of them is $15 and under.
Right.
One of them is $17 and under. One of them is $20 and under. Then we created one $30 and under. But the fact remains is I'm tasting wines primarily $20 and under every week, and I'm amazed at the quality.
But aren't you also amazed that because, I guess this is my point, because there are now so many great wines under $20, that somehow some wineries are able to sell 10,000 cases of really crappy wine that's, $11. I think people still need help learning the distinction. I mean, there's still a lot of bad wine out there. You still got to know a little bit or go to a wine merchant that you trust or a sommelier that you trust or take your class or something, right?
I totally agree with the statement that you made. You must find the right retailer. Wherever you are, find and let them work with you on first of all, your budget and also your sense of taste. They want to keep you as a customer. Now, I would have never said that 40 years ago because the retailers then were just selling, as I said, liquor. They knew nothing about wine. But today's retailer, if they don't know wine, they're out of business. And I also would go to restaurants that specialize in wine at the right prices. I was at a restaurant last night in New York City called Landmark.
Sure.
It's in Time Warner Building, but you also, Mark Murphy's got one downtown.
Mm-hmm.
I did a survey for Zagat about 3 years ago, and not on who had the best wine list in New York, because anybody can do that anywhere. But who had the best selection under $50, under $75, and under $100? And actually, the restaurant that came in the best was Landmark. And I just wanted to go there last night just to see if they were still doing it. what a great selection of half bottles they have, for example. And you could sit at the bar and have a half bottle of wine, and the pricing is what I'm saying, that extremely good pricing. So I would go to find the right retailer. I would go to the right restaurant that doesn't rip you off on pricing, and take it from there. And of course, yes, take my wine class. Thank you.
You're welcome. Two things. One is, when you do that survey in New Jersey, I can't wait for someone to do that, because wine is often, you know, we've commented that in the major publications in New Jersey, wine is
Francis and I were talking about this last night, that most restaurant reviewers in the state of New Jersey don't discuss the beverage program.
I don't think their publications give them a budget to buy wine, but they never have discussed wine service and how you can rate a fine dining restaurant that has a full wine service and not mention their wine program or their beverage program is amazing to me.
Well, I have to look at the New York Times as the leader in that, and every review that they have, you will see. On every Wednesday, they review the food, the ambiance, what to select. And they also review the wine and beverage program. So, yes, I believe it should be part of it. The biggest problem there, and don't get me wrong about this, but, you know, I'm in the wine business. You guys are in the wine thing. You're also in the restaurant business.
Yeah.
You guys happen to know wine and food, but I don't think every reviewer knows that much about wine.
Yeah.
They do know about, cooking, et cetera.
I'll tell you, though, I think if they're reviewing the restaurant experience, though, they should.
Yeah, I was just about to add. Don't you think that should be part of what a restaurant reviewer's job is?
Right now, everybody's cut back so much. In the old days, there used to be so many wine writers. The Daily News had one. The Post had one. The New York Times still has it. It's crazy because the wine sales are the best they've ever been.
Right, right.
And they have less wine writers and they have less food writers. So everybody's cutting back. So.
Well, and you'll find that in a lot of these great restaurants, they'll derive 30 or 40% of their revenue from wine. So how do you review a restaurant and not review 40% of what they're doing for the living? It's like saying, I'm going to review a symphony orchestra, but I'm not so good with the strings and the trumpets I don't know so well.
I'm
you
a
know?
Brass guy.
Well, I don't think the consumer even understands that without the liquor license, that most restaurants wouldn't be able to survive.
Yeah.
Because their profit is not derived from the food, it's derived from the drinks and, hopefully, good wine.
And hey, you know, I want to point out one other thing to our listeners is that, while I think it's great to have wines under, you know, that you really should be able to judge a restaurant by the wines in any price category you choose. One thing that we actually have people say once in a while in online reviews, and it kind of breaks my heart, and we put a little disclaimer on the front of our wine list, we have 775 bottles on our list. We have 75 wines under $50, and we have 150 wines under $75. And people will say, their wine list is so expensive. And I think, well, no, it's not. We get a fair, we're fair as far as pricing is concerned, and we have... 75 wines. That's as big a list as most restaurants have. But I think that some people in New Jersey are intimidated, even if you offer expensive wines. You know, mm-hmm. Do you find that at all?
Well, I was confronted by that when Windows on the World opened, and we're talking about the year was 1976. And the way I got around that is I did have very expensive wines, but I also separated by two lists. I had a small list of 100 wines, and the highest priced wine was $75. That's the list that I handed to the customer.
Mm-hmm.
But on
mm-hmm.
the bottom of that list, it also said, if you're interested in our cellar selections, we have another list that you can look at. So you satisfy both groups of people. So there's I think people are intimidated. 700 wines, that's a lot of wines.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, Francis, but I just think that I don't even know if I want to be handed a list that's got 700 wines on it. Give me the right price point, and a good selection. And I was able to do that. You can do that with 100 wines.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's...
Having two. Some people have even three lists. And so just to try to make it easier.
You know, when you walk in, Kevin, we just open a bottle of the most expensive champagne, bring it right over the table, and tack it on your bill. That's only for Kevin Zarelli. That's a Kevin Zarelli treatment, though. That's all we've got. So let me ask you about... what you think? Okay, we all recognize that there's been a change, and I think that you're an agent of that change in the popular perception of wine. But one of the things I like about your new book is you have these sidebars of what the statistics were in the 1970s when you started in the business versus what the statistics are today. And that appears throughout the book, which is kind of, that was very interesting to me to see the different areas where wine has changed and how it's changed in the popular perception. What were the, were there lightning rods? Were there specific moments? What happened to American culture besides just Windows in the World that opened up people to wine?
I think the quality of American wines, obviously originally California, and now every state in the United States of America has at least two wineries. So people, it's now become part of our tradition. It's interesting to note that wine consumption in the United States has gone up, but in France and Italy and Spain over the last 40 years has dropped 50%. These are the kinds of things I look at around the world, and that's the other thing. When I went around the world, I saw that all arrows were pointing to the United States of America. Everybody wants to sell their wines here. So if you're in the metropolitan area, you can get any wine you want, that's great news for the consumer. But I think that American wines in general, people could pronounce them. They didn't have to speak French. They didn't have to speak Italian or German. They could order the wine and just say, I'll have a Chardonnay or I'll have a Pinot Noir. I think that helped it. The restaurants also got online realizing that they had to do better wine lists. Hey, look it. I know because I go on 17 to go home because I live in New Paul's. So I take in 17. I stop at some of those diners on 17. They have wine lists.
Yeah, isn't that great?
And not just like, inexpensive. They have some interesting wines on their wine list. So diners, it's gone that far, which is, I guess, that says something about Americans do like a glass of wine.
Yeah.
So you think that by just naming our wines by grape type, Cabernet Sauvignon, Chardonnay,
That was a gateway?
That made it easier for people, that people could decipher a wine list easier and gave people an opportunity to buy the wines
that
they wanted. Well,
still today, we have, let's say old world, new world, okay? So the old world is by region. So in Italy, it's Tuscany, or it's Chianti. In France, it's Bordeaux or Burgundy. They don't tell you the name of the grape. In Spain, it's Rioja. You guys know this, but I think that a lot of people don't get that picture. But in the U.S. and Australia and Chile and Argentina and New Zealand and South Africa, it's done by the grape variety. So I see that as a major if something's hard, people are not going to do it. In your restaurant, if the desserts are so far away that the server doesn't even want to go that far, they're not going to try to sell them. So trying to make everything simpler, yes, I do believe that having the varietal name on it did help a lot.
You know who else was and we haven't mentioned on the show, that there was another gentleman who really brought the story of wine to America in a very digestible way, who passed away just recently, and I know that you knew him very well, was Frank Pryle just passed away recently. He was really instrumental. He was a New York Times wine columnist for a long time, a journalist in his own right besides that, but he brought some really fascinating stories. I mean, I read him
and
through
for
the
a lot
80s
of us,
and 90s.
He was the first wine person that we read religiously.
Well, the most important thing that you guys, I know you know this, but the listeners should know, he was from New Jersey. He lived in New Jersey.
Yeah, he ate in our restaurant once in a while.
Right, and he was what I would call street reporter, and told it like it was. And he loved wine. He loved everything French. Mm-hmm. Definitely a Francophile, and in those days when he started, that's really what it was primarily French wines. But he didn't like any fluff, and he said so. And he created a lot of common sense. Maybe that's the word, the common sense approach to wine. He was one of my mentors. We basically started at the same time. He started at the Times in 1970, and actually I did go to his memorial was last week in New York City, and with his wife Jean, and also his son Frank was there. He had three boys. So you get to know the people as well. It's a very, as you know, a very tight-knit community that we live in.
And, he was writing from a very American perspective and writing pre-Robert Parker. And, his mission was to weave a narrative and to tie you into the place and the history and make some sense of things, which I really respect. And, I think there's a lot of really great wine writing today. And I think one of the things that's happening again is we're returning to the narrative and the story, and we're getting away from a sort of a point criticism scale. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think let me preface. I've never used a number to describe a wine. Okay.
Right.
Matter of fact, I tasted a wine the other day, and I gave it to somebody, and I said, you know, this wine is really, really, really does not isn't up to snuff. And the guy said to me, but have you seen the scores on it? And you know, I didn't even know how to. There was no rebuttal at that point. I'm telling you, it doesn't taste the way it should.
Right.
Who cares what some other critic gave it?
Right.
So I've never really used numbers, and I've never used British poetry either.
I will occasionally haiku.
Sometimes.
Oh, because it fits grip on a label.
I got a lot of grip in the wine. You know,
yeah,
I'll
grip
use that every once in a while.
Yeah.
My whole approach has been you like it or you don't like it.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that was Frank Pryl's approach. But again, the number system did not hinder wine sales.
No, it helped. It made it accessible. I think it oversimplifies. Although I think, I mean, Kevin, you'll admit there are wines that you get and they're, it's not just I like or I don't like. There are wines that are technically flawed or brilliant examples of what they're supposed to be. But wouldn't you say that there are some objective standards?
Yeah, but I've got to say, in today's world of technology and winemaking, and we can thank the University of California at Davis and Fresno State for worldwide making worldwide better wines.
Mm-hmm. Quality.
You can actually make a $6 bottle of wine that actually tastes good. So that all that stuff didn't really exist as it does 40 years ago. So I think there's a lot of good wines on the marketplace. And are you going to run into technically flawed wines? Absolutely. But the percentages are much lower than they used to be. I was sitting with the guy that I tasted with at Sherry Lehman, and, you know, he's been doing this as long as I have. And he said, my God, remember what it was like 30 years ago?
Yeah.
You know, we rejected half the wines.
Yeah.
Because they were, you know, they had some kind of flaw.
Mm-hmm.
Winemaking flaw, or somebody didn't do this and somebody didn't do that, and they just put it out to market, or they were oxidized, or they weren't stored properly.
Stored
improperly
was amazing. I couldn't believe the number of wines that had issues because of storage or transportation.
Yeah, well, in the old day, I remember working as a salesman for a short period of time, and I went into the warehouse of this big wholesaler to look for wines that they had hidden there that they didn't even know that they had. But the warehouse was 75 degrees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and then there were no refrigerated trucks taking them in, into the stores. And then the store took it out and they put it in the window so the sun could hit it.
Yeah,
But you could see it, but the sun could hit it. It is something that's a fragile product, and you got to take care of it.
Yeah, there were certain companies, and I remember this when we first opened. There were certain companies that delivered in here in New Jersey that we knew we could buy a wine on release in October, November, but we better not buy that wine in June or July.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Because it was going to be finished.
Yeah. Right.
But it should.
Everybody should know that, but that has changed. I mean, wine is now delivered in refrigerated
trucks.
You know, it's changed for the most part, but there are still one or two companies out there that do. They're in the vast minority now, but there are still companies that send stuff out, and it arrives the temperature of warm milk. Unhappy. Hey, Kevin, can you stick with us? We have to take a quick break. We'll come right back on the other side.
Yep.
You are listening to the Restaurant Guys at RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Don't go away.
Economy Paver and Restaurant Supply Company is the oldest dealership in New Jersey. They've been equipping and supplying restaurants since 1932, and they know that to make great food, you need great equipment. You need equipment that doesn't break down, and you can't pay too much for it. Whether you need an emergency replacement or a wholesale kitchen renovation, Economy's knowledge, experience, and integrity are indispensable. Economy Paver and Restaurant Supply is a recognized dealer for all major brands, and they specialize in custom fabrication and ventilation. At Economy, they've got all the tools you need to get the job done, all in one place, all priced right, and delivered to your door. You can visit the Economy Demo Kitchen on Broad Street in Clifton, New Jersey. You can also visit economysupply.com, then call them at 973-279-5500. That's 973-279-5500.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, and we're having a great conversation with Kevin Zraley. And we've talked about the wine world in general, but Kevin, I got to talk about your book here. Now, this is the best-selling wine book in the world, certainly the best-selling wine education book in the world. We have used it. I took your class, 20-something years ago, and I came back, and before we even had our own restaurant, I started teaching wine classes and using your book as the primer. Now, the book has continued and grown, and you've updated it every couple of years or
We've been
year.
Using your book to teach our class for 22 years.
Wow. And every person on our staff gets one of these at the front of house when they come in, and we learn from it. It's the basic. But this is a big change, and one of the reasons we thought to have you back on the show, I thought this was a brilliant idea. Can you tell us the ways that you've updated the current issue of Kevin Zraley's Windows in the World Complete Wine Course?
Well, first of all, thank you for promoting the book, not only for the passion of wine, but also to help my kids get through college.
You're welcome.
So there's a dual thank you there. And actually, the book that you have is the 27th edition, the new one. It's now out in paperback just for this year, actually. We're going back to the hardcover for next year. But we wanted to make it accessible for colleges and universities. That was one of the things. And if you can recall, back in your early days of wine, the very, very early days, and you walked in into a store and you couldn't say, you know, I mean, this is going back to what we were talking about before about grape varieties, but could it Trockenbaren aus Leser? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
you
yeah.
say that. So you didn't buy it, or Gewürztraminer, or Brunello di Montalcino. So it has always fascinated me that languages are half the battle.
Right.
You have to understand the language to be able to buy the wine. You can't say you can't buy it. And so, of course, I'm not a master of any language, but I do speak enough French, enough Italian, enough German, but I learned that that's all wine languages that I speak. Anyhow, you know, technology is with us, and I'm very lucky. I'm with the same publisher now for 27 years, Sterling Publishing. And we talked about what else could we do, and I said, is it possible, is there any way possible that we can add audio to the book? And they said, well, how can we do that? So the QR codes, which are out there that all smartphones can, you know, access, it's a free app. And you actually can now click on, I'm sure you've seen it in the back of the book. So let's say you're in the Italian chapter, okay, and you take your phone and you click on the QR code, and you will have then a list of all of the Italian wine names. And you just put your finger on it, click it, and you'll hear it on your phone. There are 1,300 different wine words.
Isn't that great? That's fantastic, Kevin. That's
great. I'm very happy. Yeah, I'm very happy about it. It's even more important to me what I've learned about languages. It shouldn't be me saying it because I'm an American. So I use the University of Pennsylvania and their language department. So when you hear somebody say Brunello di Montalcino, it's an Italian saying it, not me. Or you hear Rioja, you'll hear a Spaniard saying that. And it goes on and on and on. Especially for young staff in a restaurant, you know, 18 to 25-year-old men and women who want to sell wine, if they hear it, they'll be able to sell it and say it, they'll be able to sell it better,
you know, and
as well as the consumer.
Well, and the other things that you have going on in the book, I mean, at the beginning of each chapter you have where you can link to a quick little video from you. And what's wonderful about that is, you know, the thing about paper, the thing about books on paper is they're static. But this is not static because you can make changes, you can make updates. And, you know, I think it's brilliant merchandising as well, but you link to wines because one of the wonderful things about using your book in the consumer classes that we teach or the professional classes that we teach is, you know, I say, okay, here, read about this in the book and here are some examples of that. But when people would try and do that at home, they're like, well, I'll buy a Chianti and I'll buy a Brunello, but is this a good Chianti?
Right, I won't know. If this is considered an oaky Chianti
Right. So, but when you can use the QR code and you can recommend wines, and the thing about wines, of course, is that whatever you know this year changes next year. You can update that, so the book lives. That's fantastic.
I just finished doing more videos. And so the videos will go into, you know, how do you update, you know, every year? I actually do the book every year. And I'm working on it now for the next, will come out next holiday season, so it takes that long, you know, to process. But, you know, vintages change, the personalities change, there's now a grape shortage going on in the world, which there wasn't a few years ago. That changes the whole picture of especially those inexpensive wines you were talking about. But the videos, are great, and we're actually adding, we are adding 300 to the next edition, food words. Because that's the chapter that I'm tackling right now. We have a chapter in the book called Wine and Food, which I actually co-wrote with Andrea Robinson when she was 21 years old or something like that.
Right.
She was working at Windows. But I'm tackling that, and I'm doubling the size on Wine and Food because I think people want to know. I don't think there's any answers to the question, but we're going to have, words that are hard to say, grand manger. You know, I mean, what does that mean? You know what I'm saying? But I'm just throwing out one of those words.
Sure, sure.
So they'll have food words as well, because there's so many cooking and culinary schools across the United States, I think it would be beneficial, especially to the young people.
I think that people are going to really be able to sink their teeth into this book even more than they ever have because of the things you put in here.
Absolutely. And it's a keeper. You know, it's a thing to go back to as a reference. Whether you're a consumer or, you know, starting in the wine business, you know, if you want to go on and get your Master of Sommelier degree or your Master of Wine degree or become certified on higher levels of being a professional, then you're going to need to, you know, go on to other primary source publications. But for most people's needs, this is where you go back to for the, and if you're studying one area, you still need a general frame of reference on everything else. And this is just great for that.
So just a quick question. So will you, for instance, a year from now, so if I have this edition of this book, is there a chance that a video might change?
Yes.
That you're linked to?
We're actually adding more video. Like I said, that's what I just taped about 10 different, and again, they're short. So what we've learned, you know, 30 seconds, 60 seconds max. Mm-hmm. Don't even try to go over that. Otherwise, that's too much. As a matter of fact, they're probably more informational. This was all new. I was the first time in my life I was ahead of technology. in my entire life, okay? So this was my idea. I've been implementing it. You know, we had it done 2 years ago, but the QR codes weren't perfected.
Right. They had to catch up to you.
Correct. Anyhow, it's a win-win-win situation for everybody. They get the price of the book, the paperback that we put out, is less than the regular hardcover. So they're getting a double whammy here, a less price for the book and also all the video and all the pronunciation.
And so is it true that next year we can look forward to the Kevin Israeli Gangnam Style video of you dancing? No, we're not going to see that, are we?
Actually, that's going to be in the back page.
Yeah, excellent. Parting shot.
I have just one last thing. I wanted to thank you for getting Francis and me into the Guinness Book of World Records. That was a lot of fun.
Oh, that's true, too. Yeah, you should tell them about that.
Oh, that's
you're
right.
You're going to tell them quickly about it. Yeah.
Oh, I was a very lucky guy. I was honored by the James Beard Foundation. They gave me the Lifetime Achievement Award. And actually, to accept the award, I actually did 10 push-ups on stage in front of 3,000 people in a black tie, you know. Tuxedo
and nothing else.
Let them know that I'm still alive. Uh-huh. You know, when you get those lifetime achievement awards, you wonder, well, do they know something?
Am I done?
This is it for me. So I decided to have this big party, and the idea, it was an after party, and you guys were there. The fact remains, it was to me the Guinness World of Records, the most bottles of wine opened at one time. I think there was 350 of us at the time that that happened. So we're in the Guinness World of Records, guys.
I love it.
Good news.
Totally love it.
Nobody I'd rather be in with.
The final parting shot. Mark had a different parting shot that was the pre-parting shot. Final parting shot, and we only have a couple minutes or a minute or so. What's next in the world of wine? Is it that the world of cocktails and the world of wine come together? Is it fortified wine? What's the next thing to look for in wine, Kevin?
Okay, the sad part of my whole journey that I took and finished 2 years ago is that in my lifetime there will be no new country for wine.
Yeah.
It's done. It's done. So, but what I'm going to say, what's old is new again. The Italian wines are better than they've ever been. The French wines are better than they've ever been. Spanish wines. And, of course, you have all the stuff from all over the world. I just see wine getting better. Looking for new things, and I've been doing that for the last 40 years. That's the sad part, that there's really no new wine country. There might be some new wine regions within the country, but I think we got to where we should have gotten to, and we're there.
Wow.
Great wines.
Well,
great wines,
and I'll tell you,
the world.
And if you want a guide to help you figure out the there, where we are, there is none better than Kevin Israeli's Windows in the World Complete Wine Course book, more than 3 million copies sold. You can find out more about Kevin and his classes and this book at restaurantguysradio.com. And Kevin, thanks for coming on the show again.
Thanks so much, Kevin.
Always a pleasure to talk to you.
And I hope that you only have great wines for every single day of your life.
That's the goal, brother. That's the goal. Stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com. Hey, everybody. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys. I love that guy. I really... Can I tell you something? I walked into the room when I took his first class because a guy who now works with us at our restaurant, Scott Farrar, a big shout-out to Scott Farrar, was my... my boss then, before you and I even worked together.
Right, before we worked together.
And he said, you want to learn about wine? You go, you take Kevin Zarelli's course. And I did, and I sat in that classroom, and I thought, oh yeah, I got
it. Well, he's somebody who you just, the minute you meet him, he's larger than life.
And you know, he also inspired a passion for public speaking. Mm-hmm. He's an excellent, excellent speaker. And the thing about it is to have a passion and be able to communicate it. It's like wine evangelism. You know, it's wine evangelism. But I do want to say there are some places that have produced wine that we don't see wine in America. And I think that I want to look for Turkish wines in mm-hmm. the United States. You know, they're not here yet, and they're producing great wines.
They're coming, though.
And Balkan wines in general, there's some great wines in Macedonia, and they're getting better and better. And, you know, we just brought in, little shout out, little props mm-hmm. to ourselves, we just brought in a Serbian Prokupac, that's a grape, and Cabernet Sauvignon blend, that called Su Rosa, that is phenomenal, and it's like $80 or something. But it's, you know, there's some exciting stuff going on in the Balkans. And you know what's interesting about the Balkans? And here's a little insight, because I was out in, I know that you know this, Mark, before our listeners, I was out in Sofia in the spring at the Balkans International Wine Competition. And so I got to taste a lot of wines from the Balkan countries. And, you know, with the producers there, so I know they were in great condition and all. And what I have found is that they're investing a ton in vineyards and wineries there, and they're doing some Western European varieties of grapes. Mm-hmm. So they're doing Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot and Chardonnay, and those I find generally aren't great. Okay, mm-hmm. And when they are very good, they're not as good as from the places that already do them well.
Almost always, what I've found in any region that I've gone to, that the regions that are indigenous, the grapes that are indigenous to that area are way better
yeah.
than when they try and do something that's not naturally grown there or hasn't been grown there for a long time.
And, you know, when you see some of these wineries and they'll make this Cabernet, and you're like, that's okay. And then they'll make a Prokupac, and you're like, oh, my God, that's totally new. That's a new, mm-hmm. wonderful, interesting thing. But they sort of have Cabernet envy, you know, because because
Cabernet sells.
Yeah.
One of the reasons they have envy is because they know they're going to sell more wine. You're going to sell more Cabernet Sauvignon than Prokopesh.
Right, because people can say it and they know what it is.
You just are, in the United States anyway.
Yeah, for now. Not if we can do anything about it. You know, but it's interesting. It's fun. There's still a lot of cool stuff going on in the world. And, you know, find yourself a great wine merchant or a great sommelier. One of the great things is, partially because of Kevin's efforts in the education in the wine world, used to be you went out when we were 24 years old and there was a guy who would maybe even talk a lot about wine, but he really didn't know very much, and you were as likely to get bad information as good. And there are so many people out there, whether they work in wine stores or work in restaurants, who are passionate about this and really know their stuff. It's great to go out and find somebody like that. And there are
a lot of people out like that now.
Anyway, we wish you guys the very best in 2013. Keep listening to The Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com.